You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN. I'm Ava Berardi.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. The Astoria City Council rejected two possible campsites for homeless residents. This followed more than 2 hours of discussion and public comment during a meeting Monday night. City leaders were looking to establish a designated campsite similar to one created in Seaside. They hoped for a place where approximately 35 people would be able to camp. People who spoke at Monday's meeting were overwhelmingly against proposed campsite locations in a parking lot at 2nd Street near the Astoria Riverwalk, and especially at city-owned property off Taylor Avenue, near the roundabout leading on and off the new Youngs Bay Bridge. That location is just below a neighborhood, and not far from a public park and schools. City staff noted that while the Taylor Avenue location met most of the criteria city councilors had previously established for a campsite, the proximity to residential areas could be a challenge. Astoria resident Laura Parker agreed, and along with several others, also said the location would be bad for the people camping there.
I certainly am used to the weather in Clatsop County, and after moving to Rivington Street, I can certainly say that that wind that whips through there is unlike anywhere else. If it comes off of the ocean and right over the mouth and just comes right to the point where our windows like bow in visibly. So it would be of a disservice to expect people to reside in tents in that area, in my opinion.
At the start of Monday's meeting, City Manager Scott Spence said there was no perfect location and listed the many other places city staff had looked.
We looked at Blue Ridge. We looked at city property near the treatment facility. We looked at Alderburg Park. We looked at the Customs House property. We looked at the public workshops. We looked at ADC property that's next to the Riverwalk. We looked at 13th Street. We looked at 9th Street Park. We looked at 6th and Commercial property that the city owns. We looked at the old DHS building parking lot, which is people refer to as the old Blue Building. We looked at the Columbia Avenue parking lot the city owns. We looked at port property. We looked at the old Ford dealership next to Napa. We also looked at county shops. Those sites either had too many site constraints, they had impact to neighboring properties that we could not overcome. A big issue was we could not guarantee the development of those sites because we didn't control certain aspects of that site or we did not own those sites. Plus, they did not meet the majority of the site criteria that council established for us to look at.
City councilors expressed both their frustration at lack of options and their understanding of the dilemma. They also sympathized with people worried about the impacts of having a designated campsite nearby, but said creating a campsite was an attempt to address long-standing complaints about homeless camping happening downtown. City Councilor Josh Conklin said public testimony changed his perspective on the suitability of the Taylor Avenue site as a possible place for a designated campsite, but said the city still needs to find a place for people to go.
Right now we have campsites that do not have proper resources. We do not have bathrooms that those individuals can utilize consistently. We don't have trash options for them to use. We need a different option. There's some individuals that don't have had conflicts in shelters or have issues with some of the shelters that they're going to be camping on the streets regardless. There were always going to have people in tents on the streets. And so we need a space for them. And so hearing the feedback, I do feel like these two sites are not perfect. And it's difficult because we don't have many options.
The City Council plans to discuss the issue again at a work session on April 27th. They'll debrief about the designated campsite discussion and consider how to move forward on a campsite. They will also discuss the city's current camping ordinance. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
For Latino farm workers across the U.S., trauma and inequities have long been a part of daily life, intensified by the COVID-19 pandemic. Today, many are left confronted with long COVID, a condition that's been difficult to diagnose and treat. SPR's rural affairs reporter and Moreau News fellow Monica Carrillo-Casas has more.
The first time that Dr. Anita Chabra had a long COVID patient, she cried. It was 2 years after the pandemic, she says, when the once healthy patient described symptoms of weakness, chronic fatigue, and frequently forgetting daily activities.
I still see him. He's in his late 40s, but the amount of change he dealt with, the challenges he's still struggling with, were just overwhelming.
Chopra's a lead physician at the University of Washington Medicine's Long COVID Clinic based at the Harborview Medical Center. She is also a primary care provider at the university's primary care center in Shoreline. Researchers and physicians like Chopra say they're still working to understand the long-term effects of COVID-19 and who is most affected. She says she's starting to see a broader pattern in which communities, like Latino farm workers, are hit hard by the virus. At UW Medicine, medical researcher Leo Morales has been studying how long COVID is showing up in those communities. According to his research, more than 2 in 5 agricultural workers are living with long COVID. That's one of the highest rates among occupations studied. And overall, more than 1 in 3 Latinos report long COVID, which is the highest rate among racial groups studied. Morales says early gaps in vaccine access and vaccine hesitancy both played a role in those disparities.
The best way to prevent long COVID is to prevent COVID in the first place. And vaccines are an important strategy.
At the only long COVID clinic in Washington state, Dr. Kendall Sankary says the wait list is long and the diagnosis process depends on the person. Sankary says she's had multiple patients who have worked with a primary care doctor and actually got to the point of at least suspecting long COVID as the diagnosis within a couple of months, meaning they could get the necessary referral for the UW clinic.
And then I have other patients where they've been dealing with these symptoms for, you know, 4 years and haven't come to a clear diagnosis until they're able to get into our clinic.
For farm workers, the referral and wait lists isn't the only issue. Geography also plays a role. Many farm workers live in central and eastern Washington, far from Seattle, where the clinic is based. For a long period, referrals were limited to King County, further restricting access, Sankary says.
Which is unfortunate because I know the rates are higher in that group.
Beyond distance, a 2025 report from the Washington State Institute for Public Policy found that about 40% of farm workers lack health insurance. Chopra says she dedicates 1 day a week to long COVID patients and sees about 6 people. Only about 6% of her patients have been Latino. Sankary, who sees about 16 patients a week, says she also sees very few Latino patients. Both providers say awareness and working conditions are part of the gap. In rural communities, people may not recognize long COVID symptoms or get referred for care at all. Chopra calls delays in diagnosis among Latino farm workers a social determinant of health, shaped largely by their work.
They work in eastern Washington. It is very dry. They can manifest as asthma-like symptoms, shortness of breath. Sometimes they can have chest pain. Some of them experience heart racing for no reason. That impact of COVID on their lungs makes them more susceptible to the dry condition and all the dust as well that they are inhaling.
But Chopra says their working conditions also raise a key question. Could pesticide exposure be to blame?
What we see in patients is some of them have asthma pre-existing and that can become aggravated after long COVID. Some patients who come in, they don't have any history of asthma, but now they have symptoms. Is this pesticide exposure? If they have reactive airways or new onset of asthma, then pesticide can add to it, which is why we will get a chest x-ray, we will refer them for lung function testing, but certainly pesticide exposure can superimpose on the already irritated lungs.
Sankary says that for farm workers, additional testing is important to determine whether symptoms match a clinical diagnosis, such as pesticide exposure. She says this is important because long COVID is often diagnosed based on symptoms alone. Still, Chopra says farm workers often push through symptoms like fatigue, shortness of breath, and chest pain because that's what the work demands. And for many, taking time off to see a doctor just isn't an option.
These patients are also working and sometimes the only working member in the family. So they feel like they have to keep on working and tough it out.
And unfortunately, she says with long COVID, there's no such thing. Her first long COVID patient 4 years ago is a textbook case. I'm Monica Carrillo Casas, reporting.
This story is a part of a reporting fellowship made possible by the Association of Healthcare Journalists and the Commonwealth Fund. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News Department. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org.
The American Democracy Minute is coming up next. You're listening to KMUN.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In a letter April 14th, Assistant U.S. Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon gave 14 days to Wayne County, Michigan's county clerk to produce ballots, ballot receipts, and ballot envelopes from the 2024 election. As justification, DOJ cites a handful of closed investigations from 2020 and 2024 from the county with over 1.2 million voters. Shortly after the January FBI seizure of Fulton County, Georgia's 2020 ballots, President Donald Trump said during a White House signing ceremony, quote, "But go to 2020. Look at the facts that are coming out. Rigged, crooked elections. Take a look at Detroit. Take a look at Pennsylvania. Take a look at Philadelphia. You go take a look at Atlanta," unquote. No widespread fraud was identified by city, county, or state officials in any of those areas. In a reply to the demand, Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel countered that the DOJ had not met the statutory requirements to turn over such voting records. "I am dismayed that it appears you have decided to move forward on theories similar to those deployed in Fulton County in Michigan. The courts, our officials, and our legislature have all determined that these theories are baseless, and they certainly provide no support for a demand for 2024 election records," unquote. We've linked to both letters at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org, and we'll follow this story. I'm Brian Beal.